Good morning. Good morning. Lovely to see all of you here. So, particularly in light of the fact that Chicago's an open city again. Okay. Case number one is Appeal 113478, and it's State Farm Mutual versus CIR. And do I pronounce that, Mr. Libin? Good
yes,
morning.
Ma'am. Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. We have two issues in this case, which I will cover in the argument. One is the unpaid loss issue, which this Court addressed in the Sears case in 1992. And the other is an alternative minimum tax issue, which is an outgrowth of a decision of this Court in 2004. The unpaid loss issue involves the question whether the damage award for bad faith that was entered against State Farm in litigation against one of its insureds, Mr. Campbell, properly was treated as a loss incurred on an insurance contract under Section 832b-5.
I have a question for you, and it is this. Were you obligated by statutory accounting rules to include the Campbell judgment as a loss on your NAIC statement for 2001? In other words, if you did not include it, would you have been subjected to state examination?
It's unclear whether we would have been or not, because there was no clear direction with respect to the reporting of this type of award until 2003. So in 2001, the company had to make a decision where to report it on the annual statement. It reported the amount as a loss incurred, unpaid loss incurred. It was examined by the Illinois Department and approved. Therefore, it was properly reported in that fashion.
How clear was that 2003 guidance on the question of punitive damages as distinct from compensatory damages?
The 2003 guidance states that claims-related extra contractual losses and bad faith losses should be included in losses. Bad faith losses would comprehend whatever damages are awarded in a bad faith case.
I understand that to be your argument. My question is, how clear is the guidance?
Well, we think it's clear, and our expert, who was the chairman of the committee that developed the guidance, stated in his report, Mr. Norris Clark, an exhibit in the case, that that was clearly what was intended by the language. So I think from our standpoint, it is clear what the answer is.
But it's sort of a bottom line question, I think, maybe, but how does the deduction treatment of an ordinary and necessary business expense compare to the deduction treatment of a loss incurred? How much does State Farm owe if it must recalculate its taxes and treat the Campbell judgment as a business expense instead of a loss incurred?
It is a timing question. It would lose the benefit of the deduction that it took in 2001. That would be reversed out. And then in 2003, when it paid what was finally determined to be the correct amount, it would restore to income the amount it previously deducted and get a deduction for what it actually paid if you treat it only as an ordinary and necessary business expense. So there would be a two-year difference in the
how much
swing.
Is it? How much is at stake here on this issue?
Probably around $7 or $8 million net. Because it's really only the interest factor on the benefit of claiming the deduction early rather than 2 years later when you would unwind it.
Okay, but this was sort of a mythical $200 million, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you claim it as a loss in 2001. You have to restore it when the Supreme Court reverses the judgment, right?
Correct.
Anyway.
Correct. But you don't know that in 2001.
Sure, but you're telling us that the difference between claiming it in 2001 and 2003 is $7 or $8 million?
Because in 2001, you get the tax benefit of your deduction. In 2003, you get the tax detriment
right.
of restoring it to income.
Did you restore the accrued interest?
We deducted net for tax purposes $193 million, and we restored $183 million, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So the difference was what we actually paid and were entitled to deduct.
Can I ask you to address one of the issues raised by the amicus brief, suggesting that maybe there would be good reasons, not in your case for your client's sake, but perhaps for the larger question of insurance company taxation, to distinguish between compensatory and punitive damages? You haven't made that argument.
Right.
Yeah.
We think the damages are entirely attributable to the same conduct, and they are a breach of the contract, and they produce compensatory and punitive damages in our case.
Well, how would you handle, for example, criminal fines?
Criminal fines are not deductible, so be
arising
moot
out
point.
Of at all.
That's
arising
correct.
Out of that has some similarities to
That's
punitive
right.
damages, right?
But legislatively not deductible.
You know, you didn't address the Amici's concerns. Is that because you don't think that those issues are properly before us?
No, well, I think there is a question about that, but if the court were inclined to draw a distinction between compensatory and punitive damages, we would certainly understand that.
But should we, in your view, under, you know, the normal rules of appellate practice,
well, I guess you could argue that everything is before the court, whether it's raised specifically or not, because the question is how much of the amount that was deducted should be allowed as a deduction.
Then
zero or the compensatory piece or all of it.
Then why didn't you address it?
Because in our judgment, it is appropriate to treat the entire amount as deductible.
It's only $1 million, right?
Compensatory in this case.
In this case.
Nobody expected the punitive damage reward.
Let me ask you about that.
Go ahead.
On compensatory, I look at the sort of thing, I look at it, risk. And obviously insurance companies calculate a risk, and that's what when you have insurance. And then when you get to compensatory, I try to compare it to regular companies. I look at, say, the drug companies take a lot of risk in R&D, yet they know there are going to be lawsuits at some point. And I don't know whether that's an anticipated risk that they can insure for or whether I also distinguish punitive and compensatory, but the compensatory at least raises a question with me, so I don't know where we're going to resolve that.
No, I understand, and there is a logical distinction to draw it. And if the court is so inclined, we would understand that, obviously.
When estimating loss reserves for underwriting purposes, do you know if actuaries generally include past punitive damages awards in their calculations, or are they too rare, too unpredictable to be of real use in the underwriting process?
No, you're correct, Judge Roffner. They are too rare, and they're not really factored in by the actuaries. And, in fact, in rate making and other incidents where issues may arise like that, they are removed because they do represent rare and unusual events.
And I don't know if you would know this, but I was wondering if the auto insurance premiums in Utah increased in the wake of the original Campbell judgment. In other words, was it a loss on the contract in the sense that it impacted future underwriting?
I don't believe there's anything in the record that would answer that question.
No. I don't know how my brothers feel, but maybe we ought to go on to pre-adjustment alternative
All right. I would just...
Minimum taxable income, words that now roll off my tongue.
Your favorite subject, I'm sure. I would just summarize the first point by saying your decision in Sears said you followed the annual statement, and this was approved, reviewed, and approved and properly reported. So in our view, the entire amount should be treated as a loss under the contract. On the alternative minimum tax issue, we are moving from what was the book income regime that was involved in the prior State Farm case to the adjusted current earnings, or ACE, regime in this case.
Tell me this. Was the Non-Life's group $5.8 billion loss in 2001? Was that a record loss? In other words, would this issue even arise if the non-life losses hadn't been so dramatic?
Well, it arises when they're large enough to create this issue, and it's an arithmetical calculation. As you,
was it a record loss?
Not to my knowledge, in the sense that it was very large, but as we know, property casualty companies have cyclical periods, and in some years they have terrible losses, and in other years they have substantial profits.
If you would assume that we agree with you that the rule urged by the commissioner artificially distorts the adjusted current earnings when there are non-life losses, that's still a problem for Congress to address, isn't it?
Well, Congress has not addressed it. The IRS has not addressed it. Nobody has addressed it specifically.
Us?
We had no choice. It's in your hands. We really did what we thought was the right approach, took the right approach, because the result urged by the government and by the tax court produces what we consider to be a result that's impossible. It concludes that there is positive economic income in the year where we had a gigantic loss.
How much did you lose?
We lost overall $5.2 billion before taking into account the tax-exempt income, which properly comes into the picture.
And under your arithmetic,
yeah,
the loss is $9 billion.
The arithmetic of our calculation increases it to $9 billion only because we had prior years where we had positive adjustments that were adverse to us.
Mm-hmm.
And the rule for negative adjustments is they're allowed only to offset prior positive adjustments.
Could we agree with you on this issue without holding that the phrase consolidated pre-adjustment AMTI means two different things in two consecutive subparagraphs of the regulation?
It probably is technically difficult to get there, but if you simply said that the calculation has to reflect the reality, which is the overall net loss.
My question is more formal, yeah, about the interpretation of the regulation.
Yes. I think it may be difficult literally to overcome the wording without saying it has two different meanings.
Yeah. Okay. Obviously, that can be done under compelling circumstances.
Correct.
I gather that the term economic loss is not a phrase that appears in the relevant sections of the Internal Revenue Code.
Appears in the legislative history, because that is exactly what the entire AMT is aimed at, economic income. Groups with substantial economic income, and that's the term Congress used.
And what was your economic loss for 2001?
$4.2 billion net economic loss.
And you tell us the arithmetic then requires us to count that as $9 billion.
Well, if the way the numbers work in this case, that is what would happen only because we had prior exposure to the AMT in earlier years. Otherwise,
you suggested, Mr. Libin, in your brief that, in essence, because of the lack of guidance, everybody ought to simply defer to a reasonable conclusion by the taxpayer.
Yes.
Why isn't it reasonable to conclude that you got it right the first time when you actually filed the return rather than when you were asserting counterclaims once you got into the dispute over the punitive damages issue?
When we filed the return, Judge Hamilton, we used the subgroup method. this court in State Farm 1 said that was not the right method, that a consolidated method was required. Therefore, we had to refile.
Sort of a mean question, but are you able to cite a specific code provision or regulation that explicitly would support your claim that you should never have positive adjusted current earnings in a year when the consolidated group has an aggregate loss?
There is no specific provision.
Yeah.
Oh. That's the gap that we're dealing with. And that's why we say when there is a gap of this sort, and the IRS has had 25 years to produce some specific guidance on this. They have not done that because we think they realize there is a real problem here in the way the rules would apply. And so we took our best shot at it. And there is authority that says where the commissioner could provide guidance and doesn't, then it's appropriate for the taxpayer to come up with its reasonable interpretation, and if the court believes it's reasonable, it should be accepted.
So in the absence of specific rules for non-life consolidated, for a life non-life consolidated group, are you a liberty to choose any possible reasonable calculation, or must you first maybe defer to the rules for regular consolidated groups?
No, we would adhere to what Congress intended. We would say, what was Congress trying to accomplish here?
Well, didn't Congress say, though, that in the absence of other guidance, you comply with rules for regular corporations and other groups.
But they were not thinking of the life, non-life issue in that case, because the life, non-life issue, if you apply their rules, produces the impossible result of positive income when you have a net loss.
So does your argument then require us to scrutinize the psychology of the Ways and Means Committee and the Finance Committee and their staffs as they drafted these complicated rules?
Not the psychology, just what they said in the report, which is we're looking to tax groups with substantial economic income. Therefore, the test is, did this group have substantial economic income? No, economic loss.
Did you incur AMT liability for 2001?
No, because of the loss.
Yeah.
But we incurred AMT liability in prior years, and that's the only reason why our loss would increase from the $4 billion to the $9 billion.
So we have dragged you into your rebuttal time.
I will sit down. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Mami. Or Tamami? Yes?
You got it right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Francesca Tamami, counsel for the Commissioner of Internal Revenue. I'd like to address probably the AMT issue first, since that's the most complicated and it's fresh on everyone's mind. My opposing counsel said that there is a problematic gap in the way that the ACE adjustment works for life, non-life consolidated groups. However, there is no specific guidance for life, non-life groups, but there are no gaps. And in fact, State Farm is the only insurance company that has raised this issue in the 25 years since the ACE scheme was enacted. There are default rules that apply in the absence of the specific guidance. First of all, if you look at the definitions in Section 56 G1 and G3 of the Internal Revenue Code, ACE is defined is specifically based on this concept of pre-adjustment AMTI. State Farm does not dispute that pre-adjustment AMTI reflects the loss limitation rules of 1503C. Congress expressly based ACE on that same concept of pre-adjustment AMTI, so the loss limitation rules flow throughout the ACE adjustment.
So basically, I think what you're saying is I'm going to make a fool of myself. No, what I think you're saying is that the regular tax code contemplates that the consolidated taxable income of a life, non-life group is not meant to be less than zero. That's what you're saying.
Correct.
Okay. But the adjusted current earnings calculation contemplates the possibility of a negative adjustment.
That's
correct. So is such a negative adjustment ever possible if, as you're saying, I think you're saying, the loss limitation rules have to be applied to both calculations of pre-adjustment AMTI?
A negative ACE adjustment still is possible because the ACE adjustment ultimately is based on the specific adjustments that are required under 56G4, things like tax-exempt interest income, the reversal of various other tax deductions, dividend received deduction, depreciation. So if those particular items for a taxpayer turn out to be negative, then they can have a negative adjustment regardless of whether or not their overall income, their group income was positive or negative. In this case, there's no dispute that the 56G4 adjustments were positive for all of the years. They were about $1 billion. And ultimately, what the ACE adjustment seeks to do is to subject to tax that particular subset of items, those items that are otherwise normally left out of the tax computation. And it seeks to add on, as part of the AMT computation, 75% of those adjustments. So if all of those adjustments are positive for the particular year, then the ACE adjustment is basically 75% of that total. That is how the math works out here. If all of those adjustments are negative for the particular year, then 75% of a negative number yields a negative adjustment if the taxpayer can otherwise claim the negative adjustment. There are some other rules that are not at play in this particular case.
How does your proposed computation of ACI serve your stated purpose of taxing reported profits better than State Farm's computation does? Specifically, how do you explain the fact that State Farm's ACE figure for 2001 is positive despite the astounding $5.8 billion loss that year by the non-life subgroup?
The ACE number is positive because under the Internal Revenue Code, the starting point is adjusted alternative minimum taxable income. That's the starting point. For a life, non-life group, that number cannot be negative. It can be zero or it can be positive because of the loss limitation rules of 1503C. So the starting point for ACE cannot be a negative number that fully nets the losses.
Can I ask you, Ms. Tamami, the reply brief filed by State Farm has a table at page 24 comparing four alternative scenarios that seems to produce arbitrary results under the commissioner's method. None of us are unacquainted with arbitrary aspects of taxation now and then, but could you address that that table, what you think of it, and where you think it fits into the argument here?
Yes, I have to admit I was also confused by the table. In the reply brief says that the table reflects the commissioner's view, and I've never seen that table before, and it was hard for me to understand how that lines up with the commissioner's arguments in this case, because the various labels in the table, it doesn't say what was the pre-adjustment AMTI of the different companies. It doesn't actually say what the ACE adjustments were. So it was hard for me to figure out how does that table line up with our arguments. I think the takeaway piece from that table is that, again, it shows positive 56G4 adjustments for all of the different scenarios, mm-hmm. and the adjustment is supposed to be 75% of those items. So when those items are positive, and in each one of those cases the items were positive, the adjustment itself, which is not shown in the table, should be positive. Otherwise, I thought, frankly, the table was rather useless because it also doesn't give background information as to the previous. I think it included information about they had losses in previous years that could be offset.
That's the variable in the chart, is whether the last 5 years they were losing money or making money.
Right. And that should not enter the calculation of what is the ACE adjustment in a particular year. That might affect the question, if you had a negative ACE adjustment, can you take it? But in terms of doing the first calculation, calculating your ACE, determining your adjustment, the fact that there were losses in previous years doesn't enter into the determination.
If I got this right, that the relevant regulations have been pending as proposed regulations for 19 years at this point?
That, as far as I know, that's correct. They are regulations that would not apply to life, non-life groups. They would apply to general consolidated groups.
Okay. Is that unusual, the 19 years of pending proposed regulations? This is 1986 legislation, right?
In my own experience, that is somewhat rare, but not completely unknown to happen. I think it just is based on administrative priorities within the Department of Treasury.
If this case didn't bring it to the forefront, nothing will.
Well, those proposed regulations wouldn't actually address the question presented in this case. And again, I realize the issue in this case is very confusing. Specific guidance would be helpful, but this issue has only come up in 25 years in this one case. Other taxpayers, including State Farm, have managed to successfully report their ACE adjustments each year on their tax returns. I think this is due to the fact that the default rules that exist in the code and the internal regulation and the Treasury regulations fill the gaps that the taxpayer is drawing to the court's attention.
Could you tell me why adjusted current earnings replace the use of book income?
Well, they were actually enacted together in, I believe it was 1986, and as far there's not really any explicit reasoning in the legislative history. However, I read in a GAO report that actually the taxpayer cited in its brief that for the first couple years, Congress decided to base this adjustment on book income to sort of make the process more transparent or maybe understandable for the general populace, but then the idea was to move specifically to a tax concept, ACE, based on AMTI after a couple years.
Okay, so let's go to losses, you know, the Campbell judgment. Let's go there, because I'd sure love to know what the basis for your position is. The $202 million Campbell judgment didn't comply with the NAIC rules. I mean, after all, State Farm's 2001 reported reserves were reviewed. They were approved by PricewaterhouseCoopers and were also deemed acceptable by a multi-state team of insurance examiners.
That is correct. I think, as my opposing counsel mentioned during his opening argument, at the time there was no clear guidance from the NAIC on how to report these damages. The commissioner's position in this case has been that the NAIC rules would not have permitted it. It was the statutory accounting principle number 55, which is the one that explains how to compute loss reserves, and it specifically states that it doesn't apply to punitive damages. And that it continues to state that. So in the commissioner's view, at the very least, the punitive damages portion should not have been included in loss reserves, although we think here the compensatory damages are just as attributable to the same tortious acts, and so they should be considered together.
But isn't it pretty clear, though, that the NAIC at least treats compensatory damages as something that ought to be treated as part of unpaid losses?
I don't know that that's clear. The only guidance from the NAIC is the 2004 interpretation, 03-17. It doesn't provide any definitions. I guess one could argue that it might reach compensatory damages for torts.
It must mean something, right? Extra contractual obligations?
That may be. I haven't seen any other NAIC publications. I'm not aware of state practices following that.
If it doesn't apply to compensatory damages in cases like this, what does it apply to?
Yeah. Well, the commissioner's experts in this case, and I think the amici brief also addresses what extra contractual obligations, for the most part, encompass payouts pursuant to the insurance contract but beyond the policy limits. For example, let's say an insured has an accident. They believe they were covered for a certain type of loss. It turns out they weren't. But the insurance company pays it anyway because they want to avoid getting into a dispute with the insured. It just is easier. So they make payments over the policy limits. The commissioner's experts testify that those are the kinds of extra contractual obligations that are considered as being part of the losses that are included in losses.
So that would be a payment designed to head off a bad faith judgment.
Perhaps, depending on
the
rationale.
That's why you pay more than the policy limits, right?
Correct, but it would still be a payment that relates to the insured event, an expense directly attributable to the insured loss.
Mm-hmm. The award in the Campbell judgment, however it's characterized, ultimately stems from the underlying insurance contract with Campbell, right?
I'm sorry, could you repeat your question?
The award. No matter how you would, characterize it, ultimately what it stemmed from would be the underlying insurance contract with Campbell.
It's a but-for cause, right?
Yeah. If State Farm's bad practices caused the damages award, then the judgment very literally would flow from State Farm's underwriting activities, right?
Only if you take a very broad view, correct, a but-for causation type of view. If Campbell had not been one of their insureds, they never would have engaged in tortious misconduct towards him. They never would have had to pay damages to him. But I think the relevant point here is even if State Farm had a fiduciary duty that arose from the contract, that duty is simply one element of the tort cause of action that Campbell had. There was a separate intervening tort on the part of State Farm that is the direct result or the direct cause of those damages.
Well, in light of your claim that the Campbell judgment was a business expense, could you provide any other example of a business expense that would properly appear in the calculation of loss reserves on an insurer's NAIC statement?
It's hard for me to think of a specific example because the code allows deductions for both. It's just a question of, and all of these things show up somewhere on the annual statement, whether it's loss reserves, whether it's expenses, and the code allows a deduction. The question is, which code section allows the deduction and when are you allowed to take it? So the entire world of business expenses are allowable as deductions under the code, but not as a loss reserve.
So are you willing to concede that the Campbell judgment was a loss relating to an insured event under Principle 55, whatever?
No.
You're not?
Correct.
Okay. Why not?
Because it was not, I think the definition of losses incurred in the Internal Revenue Code is losses on insurance contracts. That means losses flowing from the insured risks, a loss that State Farm is required to pay pursuant to its insurance contract with its insured. The insured risk under the auto contract with Campbell was not State Farm's torts. The insured risk was automobiles as either the thing causing injury or the thing sustaining injury. There was a separate intervening conduct on State Farm's part that is the direct source of the Campbell judgment. Losses incurred is meant to cover losses that are insured under the insurance contract, whereas expenses incurred, which are allowed as a deduction under other code sections, reach the other types of expenses that insurers incur that are not directly attributable to insured losses.
Well, I really asked as far as risk. I use that word because this is how decisions are made. You have to anticipate a risk or calculate it or something, and it's always based on history. You know what's gone on, and so you anticipate these things. And this is where I, can see a separate between punitive, which, frankly, these folks have tried a lot more juries than I have. I was never a trial judge, but at the same time, you know, a jury can sometimes run away with punitive damages, which is what they did in this case, because they went after the whole company. Said, hey, State Farm is big and everybody knows they won't pay and all that stuff. So they get this huge award, which is probably the only reason it got here, because it was so big that it does have this after-the-fact injury of $8 million because of a two-year delay, and it's just huge. Otherwise, that's maybe why we haven't seen it in 20 years or whatever it is. But it still seems that when you get into the risk calculation, I don't know how I can understand when you, it's like when you have huge hurricanes, you know, that's when there are big losses. But you hope that you have a less hurricane season. Well, in this case, true, they didn't settle the case. And a little case ran away and suddenly got way out of hand. When other lawyers got in and found out new ways to sue. So
congratulations.
I'm getting educated by everybody's questions because, frankly, I don't understand this AMT thing and how it gets there. All I know is whenever I get personally stuck with the AMT, I'm not happy a bit.
You've had to suffer twice as far as I know.
You do your tax return twice. You know, after you do this one, now, okay, now here's what you really owe. And then, of course, what you talk about, whatever these adjustments come up with, somebody finds out, well, gee, you shouldn't have done that because you got a capital gain. That kicked you into some other category, and therefore, and of course, here we're talking about so many millions of dollars that I don't comprehend it. I don't have much of a question. Most of it, I just say I'm perplexed with this, and I wish there were a lot more. This is going to be a case of first impression and, I hope, last impression.
It is, and I think Your Honor has you've touched on an important point, that the risk of incurring this kind of punitive damage loss was not something that's foreseen under the insurance contract. As my opposing counsel stated during his opening argument, and the commissioner's expert below also testified to at the trial, punitive damages are extremely rare. It is extremely rare to have punitive damages result from an auto insurance contract, and they are never taken into account in rate making in terms of determining insurance premiums.
But compensatory, would those be taken into consideration?
The evidence in this record was that actuaries do take into account extra contractual obligations in the nature of payments that exceed policy limits. We're going to pay for your rental car for 10 days instead of 7. Those types of things are taken into account by actuaries in rate making. There's no specific testimony as to compensatory damages.
You always have the debate of whether there's coverage, of whether there's going to be a defense. Sometimes they'll defend without underwriting.
Yes. Litigation expenses for resisted claims, those are taken into account, and those are deductible. Those are included in the losses incurred deduction as loss adjustment expenses under a separate provision of the code.
I could just ask one additional matter, Ms. Tuomi. The code here is obviously very unusual in its virtual delegation of this question to NAIC. Accounting, as we said in Sears, and has been made more explicit in statutory amendments. What would your position be if the NAIC adopted a policy statement tomorrow consistent with State Farm's experts' opinions report in this case? Wouldn't that pretty much resolve the issue?
This is something the IRS has no published guidance on this question. I think as of right now, their position is that 832B5, the losses incurred deduction, is limited to losses on an insurance contract. So,
but it's all geared to NAIC standards, right?
Well, once you get past the prefatory section of 832B5, which limits...
Well, B1 tells us to look, right, at the NAIC.
Right. But then B1 kicks it over to B5 for the definition, and it says losses on insurance contracts. So I think the IRS's position would be you certainly do defer to the NAIC, the annual statement, when it comes to a loss on an insurance contract. But this will be the big question.
But not in deciding is an insurance?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Would you be kind enough to add 3 minutes to Mr. Libin's time because we gave the extra time to Ms. Tamimi.
Thank you, Your Honor. Several points to make. First, picking up just on the last point that you were discussing, Judge Hamilton, I think the IRS does not accept the decision in Sears that defers to the NAIC. They have imposed a filter on what is includable under Section 832b5 by saying first it has to pass through a certain threshold which fits their definition and the tax court below, that it's not some sort of extra contractual loss. It has to be a loss on the contract, meaning coverage under the contract. That means companies have to keep two sets of books because they keep one set for the regulators, which includes amounts of this sort, which were approved and properly reported. And then for tax purposes, the IRS would say you keep a different set of books, which only covers these particular types of amounts. Coverage under the contract.
Well, listen to Colonial Life, or at least tells us there are at least some instances where we tolerate that, right?
Colonial Life was a life insurance company case. Life companies are taxed differently than property. No,
but in terms of there being at least where there's an explicit conflict between the Internal Revenue Code and the NAIC's standards.
In the life context, on the property casualty side, the history is clear from 1921 forward, and discussed in your Sears opinion, Congress said we defer to the regulators for property casualty. What goes in the accounts for losses for regulatory purposes is what we will accept for tax purposes. If we want to change it, we will legislate. And they did. In fact, on salvage values, there was some confusion some years back. Congress said, okay, we're clearing this point up. But otherwise, it's total deference to the NAIC on the property casualty side. The government would say, no, we want two sets of books. And that's just not correct for this issue. On the AMT side, and by the way, one of the expense items mentioned is a loss adjustment expense. Loss adjustment expenses, of course, relate to the handling of claims, the processing of claims. Those are reported on the annual statement and treated as losses under the code. So, and in this case, that would include defending the bad faith case. That would mean you'd have loss adjustment expenses that constituted losses, but under the government view, you wouldn't have a loss in the first place, which makes no sense whatsoever. On the AMT points, the chart which you referred to, Judge Hamilton, word limitations make it difficult sometimes to explain it. In our view, it's extremely clear. Frankly, you just have to think a little bit.
I think it's one word per $1,000 at issue in the case or something like that.
Could be something like that. But the point of the chart is to show four cases where the economic profile is exactly the same. And therefore, under what is intended by the ACE calculation, you should come out with the same number in all four cases. But under the government's view, because you do not apply the loss limitation rule, you do apply it under the government's view to calculate ACE, you get the bizarre results that are shown in the chart because they do not recognize this operating loss. It is removed under their calculation, and everything flows from the fact that there were simply profits. And then in one year, under our history, in one group, the loss limitation is allowed to reduce current income slightly because there's no capacity to carry it back. So there is a reduction in the current year income by 35% under the loss limitation rule. That's why the government result would show two different numbers depending on the history, both of which would be positive when, in fact, the overall result is negative and the economic profile is negative, as it was in our case. And that's this chart, we think, does really lay out the issue very clearly. And we think it shows how, under the government view, by ignoring the fact that there's an operating loss, in our case $5 billion, in this case only $30 million on the chart, you come out with very strange results. Under our view, you come out with what might be an exaggerated loss for the year, and we acknowledge that. But it's only because we had the prior exposure, and Congress, by allowing negative adjustments, was allowing you to recoup previously paid AMT in a case like this where you have a terrible year. You have a really bad year.
So, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to both parties for a well-argued